Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and welcome to the show. My guest this week is actor, writer, and director Ben Lewis, whom you may remember as Bobby Breckenridge on Degrassi, The Next Generation, or as Other Scott in Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. Ben's other recent credits include gigs on Long Story Short and Chasing Life, and behind the camera, he co-wrote, directed, and produced Zero Recognition, in which he stars with friend of the show, Lauren Collins. That was released on Vimeo late last year, and it's a lot of fun. You should definitely check it out. Ben picked Tootsie, Sidney Pollack's 1982 farce, starring Dustin Hoffman as Michael Dorsey, a self-destructively principled New York actor who indignantly disguises himself as an unknown actress, Dorothy Michaels, to make a point about sexism in the television industry, and winds up landing a soap opera gig that makes Dorothy an unlikely celebrity and gives Michael new insight into the portrayal of women in the entertainment media. It also introduces him to Jessica Lange's Julie, an actress who could be the love of his life if he can get her to see the man inside the woman. 35 years later, the gender politics are admittedly more than a little dicey, but we'll get to that. This is someone else's movie.
You know, I was the kind of kid who, on a Friday night, I would finish school, and my parents would pick me up, and we'd go to Video Flicks.
Yeah.
And I would go, and I would get, like, a stack of videos for the weekend, and, or for, you know, or for the summer, you know, it would be, and they would do, like, a 7 movies for 7 days for $10 of thing. And that was, like, that was the shit. So I would, I think, you know, through the course of my my adolescence, I think I went through pretty much every comedy, dramedy that was made in the 80s and 90s, probably. Right. Probably. And so I'm sure I saw it somewhere during that time, but I think it didn't really sort of, I don't think it really resonated with me that much when I was a kid. I remember liking it. But it's a movie that I've only sort of like, I think I sort of rediscovered in the last couple years, and now I watch it every couple of months, and every time I find out someone that I know hasn't seen it, you know, I'll sit down with them and I'll force them. And that's why I'll always buy DVDs too, because to me, there's no way to physically force somebody to watch a movie other than shoving it in their hands, you know?
Yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah.
The sense of both obligation and gift, right?
Yeah, right.
Short of sitting the person down right then and doing it, and mm-hmm. that's 2 hours you don't always have.
Yeah.
You get to say, did you watch it yet? Did you watch it yet? I know you have it.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I'll download it on iTunes. Oh, Netflix was spotty. I couldn't quite get to it. Google Play. Just stop making excuses.
Right. And I won't take it back until I know that you've watched it.
That's right.
Yeah.
You must answer me these three questions.
Exactly. There will be a quiz. So
you've obviously gone through every iteration, like DVDs and...
Yeah. So it's funny, actually, because between... I had the Criterion edition in LA, and I had the standard DVD home in Toronto.
Right.
So, you know, I know we talked about doing this, I guess, probably like a couple weeks ago. We started talking about it, and when I was here briefly doing the sort of final week of post on my short, I was watching the standard version, and then I went back and... watched the Criterion version in LA, and then I was sort of going over it. I brought the Criterion back with me, and I was reviewing it last night and watching all the special features and stuff. But yeah. So anyway, it was a movie that I guess I rediscovered it a couple years ago. The feature that Lauren and I have now done a first draft on is a sort of. I don't know, you wouldn't call it mistaken identity comedy, but sort of based on the sort of Cyrano type tropes, you know?
Sure.
So I was thinking about, I feel like it was around that time when we were sort of developing the idea for the script, that I was like, what are really great comedies sort of that style?
Right, yeah.
And so Tootsie was one of them. I think that's when I revisited it, but it may also have been when that great Dustin Hoffman AFI clip went viral. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
The one where...
where he's talking about
the ownership of the script, or...
No, it's the one where he's talking about... he's talking about doing Tootsie, and he was talking about how when he was going through the hair and makeup tests for the movie, and they did the initial hair and makeup tests, and he... what they came up with, he looked at himself and he was like, oh, I'm not very attractive. And he said to the them, he was like, do you think we can make me more attractive? And they said that this is probably the best that this is the best we're gonna do. And and he went home to his wife and he said that he started crying because he realized that if he saw him as a woman on the street, he would, or you know, at a party or whatever, he would never give that woman the time of day.
Right.
And he would have missed out on knowing potentially an extraordinary person because he had been sort of brainwashed to, you know, by sort of typical like male beauty standards,
sure,
for standards of female beauty. And
and this is in the early 80s too, where everything is sort of insanely overdone
in
terms of what female beauty was at the time.
Totally.
You know, there's even like Terry Garr even shows up in the Olivia Newton-John physical outfit at one point.
Oh, yeah.
Or something similar to it. And it's just like,
yeah,
oh,
but
that's
with
right.
jeans. It's kind of a cool. Yeah. Oh, I know what you're talking about. But she wears a couple of she has some great outfits in this movie,
the
I was
headband.
Noticing.
Yeah. And you just think, "Oh, that's right. That's what everyone had to do."
Right.
At the time to look like halfway fit, to look like they were trying. Everybody had to make an effort. And
totally.
Hoffman, who's never been, I don't think, traditionally handsome.
No.
That's the whole reason that, like, Nicholas cast him in The Graduate, because he didn't look like the person they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And then this, yeah. Dorothy Michaels is funny looking.
Yeah.
She's not ugly. She's just distinctive.
Totally.
And I also love that the thing in that story is basically that Dustin Hoffman... is just like, it's not narcissistic, it's an actor thing, right? You need to know what you look like at all times. You need to feel like you're representing properly. Mm-hmm. And the idea that he wouldn't like himself,
right,
is the most terrifying thing for an actor, for a performer, right?
Right.
Like, I wouldn't want to watch me.
But I think it's also interesting because, you know, he sort of talked about when he was a kid, he was a very deeply unattractive kid, you know, that he had acne and that he had a big nose.
Well, that nose has always been, yeah.
Right.
It's like your ears, right? They never get any.
Right,
more.
Exactly. But that he was, you know, always the shortest kid in his class. And I think he said that he sort of realized through the process of this movie, I mean, how, you know, he knew how painful that experience was for him, but how, had he been born a woman with those sort of similar features or whatever, his life would have been 50 times worse, you know, that he was able to grow out of that awkward phase, but not entirely. I mean, he's still a successful character actor.
Yeah, he sort of made it work for him. Like, the height thing. I mean,
and it worked for him, obviously, in the case of The Graduate, too, because, you know, I know that he said that Mike Nichols, you know, when he cast him, he thought, oh, this is a terrible... Dustin Hoffman thought, this is a terrible piece of miscasting, because I'm not the leading man. I'm a character actor. And then it was interesting. He also said that when he chose to do Midnight Cowboy as his follow-up film to The Graduate, that Mike Nichols called him up and he was like, what the hell are you doing? Like, I made you into a movie star and now you want to go back.
Yeah.
Now you want to go back to being not just a character actor, but to being...
Yeah.
And that performance, I mean, is
shabby, choleric, miserable.
But that's what he said that he felt like when he was growing up. Like, he felt inside that he looked like Ratso Rizzo, that he was Ratso Rizzo.
Yeah.
So that actually felt closer to him. He understood that more than he did playing whatever his idea of Benjamin Braddock was.
Yeah. But that's why he's so perfect in The Graduate, because he does look like someone who doesn't feel like he should be there. Like, that's...
Right, and that this woman would be...
character.
Yeah, and that this woman would be making advances towards him or whatever.
Both women, yeah.
Yeah, both women, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So with Tootsie... amazingly, this is something that occurred to me just yesterday, is like, for the first time, oh yeah, of course you'd have to be short, because a tall guy couldn't pull it off. A tall actor could not pull off that character, at least. I mean, there'd be a different version of it. Mm-hmm. And we have Gina Davis for Scale. The first time we see her, she's towering over him.
Yeah.
And of course,
she got hired. She got hired, like, out of a modeling book, because Sydney Pollack was like, I need an actress who's a certain height so that her breasts will hit Dustin Hoffman square in the eye.
Yeah.
And... yeah, she's never done a movie before.
That weird kind of cynicism and sexism, but working for it. But, like, it's not a bad choice.
No.
It's a really smart choice for comedy. But again, that like with everything, we didn't even get to start to unpack the sexual politics of it, which mm-hmm. is which was just amazing to me watching it now. It's probably the first time I'd say in 10 years that I'd seen it, mm-hmm. Rather than just a clip of it here or there. And it's a tightrope now. And
totally.
1982, I don't, like, I was 13 or 14. I have no idea how I processed it then, other than this is funny.
Yeah.
But now it just feels even more daring somehow.
Like, totally. And I think that that's probably why, even though when I watched it when I was a kid, I don't think any of that, I don't think I realized how smart it was. Mm. And it's actually very subtle in its, even though there are obviously like farcical elements of it, it's a relatively subtle take given on a ridiculous sort of outlandish premise.
Sure.
And the performances are so sort of subtle and grounded. And I think when I was a kid, I responded more to sort of a broader take in sure, a comedic take on similar subject matter. Because when I was a kid, and it's still one of my top five, but 9 to 5 was like one of my favorite movies when I was a kid. And that seems almost like cartoonish next to this.
Yeah. Well, it has literal cartoons for one thing.
Yeah, literal. That's true.
It creates for itself.
That's true.
And Dabney Coleman is the avatar of sexism in both of them.
He is the epitome of 80s sleaze.
Yeah. He's so good at it.
And you know what's interesting too? I don't know if you came across this in the special features, but that he was originally, Sidney Pollack cast him as the agent originally, yeah. Until Dustin Hoffman, because of the combative nature of their relationship, naturally he was like, you have to play the agent, you have to do it.
Yeah. And I love the idea as well that at that point in the process of developing the film, that Hoffman was pretty much full on Michael Dorsey.
Just
refusing to accept logical explanations for things. That had to be emotional, they had to be rooted in character,
right?
Even when it was simply, I want you to direct me as an actor while you are directing my career as my agent. That right. And he couldn't see, like, the tunnel vision involved in making a movie like this, in making any movie, obviously, mm-hmm. you can't see anything but what you're working on, mm-hmm. Is something I've always admired and been terrified of in the same measure. Because I mean, I write, I focus, but I can stop and start. I don't, like, I'm not going to lose the thread of my argument if I'm interrupted by the phone mid-paragraph. But for an actor to literally lose him or herself in a performance the way that Hoffman apparently has to make a comedy out of that is like either an incredible act of grace on his part and graciousness to allow himself to be sent up, because basically supposedly Michael Dorsey is Dustin Hoffman. He is just, you know, he's kind of humorless, kind of, even that opening scene intense. At the party where he's trying to pick up every single woman he meets, it's creepy.
He's kind of self-righteous a little bit too, in the way that he's sort of, I mean, he has to be because he's also an acting teacher, and he's sort of, you know, his role with the Sandy character is to basically be her mentor, and I think she says that when she's giving her little toast or speech when he walks in at his party. But, you know, he's sort of her professional and personal sort of mentor and guru or whatever. And one of my favorite things is how he is sort of a bit self-righteous and a bit superior with her and coaching her on the audition and stuff. And then when he takes her to the audition and finds out that the Terry Bishop, the lead on the soap, has gotten the part that he wanted in Iceman Cometh on Broadway or whatever, and then he immediately turns into the sort of needy, insecure actor. Completely abandons her, you know, breaks down Sidney Pollack's door and becomes that sort of that thing that I think all actors hate to be, or hate to admit that we are, which is, you know, we can act self-righteous, and we can, you know, get on our high horse about, you know, you, as he does, sort of about creating your own work, and certainly that's very true and valid. But at the end of the day, you know, we find out that another actor got a part that we wanted, and we sort of revert to this, it's almost this like feral sort of you know state of being, sort of childlike. And
I wanted that was mine.
Exactly.
Sure.
Exactly. Which is so to me, sort of the reason that I think that I picked it for this, and the reason that it has sort of, I think, more and more relevance to me as I get older and I get further along in my career or whatever, is that to me it's the best movie ever made about sort of First of all, the indignity of being an actor, which is something that Lauren and I sort of tried to explore in Zero Recognition as well. But also just like the passion of being an actor. Like, you know, Dustin Hoffman said in one of the interviews on the DVD that, you know, it's about sort of keeping, it's like a candle you have to keep, that has to stay lit. You know what I mean? The desire, the love of your craft, because you're going to be met with constant rejection. Yeah. So if you don't have that burning inside of you, you know, you'll fall by the wayside. And I feel that, like, when I watch this movie, you know what I mean? Like, I feel that it it's a movie based around a performance that's really about the love of performing. I feel that sort of viscerally when I watch the movie.
Yeah.
And that's certainly something that I didn't feel or pick up on when I was a kid. But the more that I watch it, you know, as an adult and in my career and stuff, the more it sort of is moving to me, actually.
Yeah. It also has so much going on about both in terms of actors and the people playing the actors, so much about representation and the way that they, and the way that people see themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Between, you know, the basic premise that Gelbart always claimed credit for, of a man learning to be a better man because he is a woman for a while.
Right.
And then clearly the device that I'm sure Elaine May brought in, which is the contrasting of the expected dialogue on the teleprompter with what Dorothy Michaels is actually saying when she becomes a feminist hero.
Right.
But it's because it's coming from a place of Michael's ego,
mm-hmm.
but it translates into an opportunity to
liberate
the character, liberate the structure of the mm-hmm. show. And because Pollock is smart enough to play the reactions of the women in the room, mm-hmm. we get to actually see what a feminist perspective is like on a show that isn't built for one.
Totally.
Because everybody is horrified.
Yeah.
Or excited. Or both.
Yeah, you can see, I think, on the faces of all the women, you know, all the reaction shots of Jessica Lange and Gina Davis. Yeah. And
but all the people on set, you know, like Ellen Foley's in there as an assistant a few times. She barely speaks. She was on Night Court for years.
Who is she into?
She's the assistant who actually, the casting assistant who comes out and said, the first one who says, she's the one who calls out the list of names.
Interesting.
And she apparently, thanks IMDb trivia,
mm-hmm.
she wasn't able to speak very much because she was recording an album and she blew her voice out.
Oh, really?
But as a result, she's got this incredibly expressive face.
Uh-huh.
And you just, every time it cuts back to her, my brain goes, oh, that's Ellen Foley. And, oh, yeah, look at
her. Is she blonde?
Yeah.
Oh, blonde, okay. Is she the one who's sort of the, when Dorothy is, refuses to, so they're doing that scene in the woman's beat up in the hospital bed, and she changes the lines to say, she's supposed to say, you should really go to therapy, and then she changes it because she says, what woman in the right mind would you say that to a woman? And she says that to the producer in the sort of booth, and then she turns to, I love that, I just noticed that the producer turns to, I don't know if she's an associate producer, mm-hmm. she's in, you know, something on the show, and the producer just sort of goes, like, nods, like, see? Like, yeah. We had that conversation in the room, you know, we talked to the writers about that, and the woman would never do that, but somehow it got, you know, got overlooked.
There are moments like that run throughout the movie, and they're not just confined to the set. There's all the stuff between Dorothy and Julie,
mm-hmm.
That dinner that goes on and on and on. And I'd forgotten just how fast the thing moves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's got the gig within 15 minutes, I think, of the film, and it just rolls right through all of it.
Yeah.
We're at the hour point before Dorothy meets Julie's father,
mm-hmm.
who
mm-hmm.
becomes a comic engine. Mm-hmm. Charles Durning is his own comic engine.
Yeah.
And,
well, that... You know, I think that opening montage that they do in the film is incredibly effective, because you get that, you know, you see all these bad auditions that he goes on, you see him. So, that thing that I was talking about where it highlights the indignity of being an actor as well as it does the sort of like the passion and the need to do it.
We get to see him,
you get that all
teacher.
In the opening montage, you know what I mean, see him be like sort of so exasperated in these bad auditions but also so passionate in his classroom, you know, and you know, giving these actors these pep talks about how you need to make your own work, and so you get you get the full sense of like what his career is and what his struggle is before the opening credits are even over. So I think that you're able to sort of like, you're right, it's like sort of boom, boom. They're able to set it up so quickly, but you feel like you know this character, and you know not only him, but you know Terry Garr's character. You have a good sense of Bill Murray's character just from that amazing party scene, and before you even get into the world of the soap.
Yeah, and then the soap opera starts to play out in real life, of course, because this is a farce, and the mirroring element has to kick in. Mm-hmm. But it does so in such a, like, it's such a weird, lovely relationship that Hoffman and Lang build, and in either character, but in as actors, I don't think I remarked on this to Kate when we were watching it again last night. It's like, I don't think I've ever seen Jessica Lange be this loose and interesting.
Yeah.
Before or since. Like, she's fun in King Kong, which is the biggest role she'd had before that, and in Francis, she's exactly what that part demands, but there's a humanism, a naturalism, something, she's responding to something in Hoffman or the material, or just the fact that the takes are longer and that there's room, and then she ends up working with Sam Shepard and they start making movies together and they get less interesting over time. Because they're both very serious screen presences in the work they did together. But she's so alive in this role in a way that I don't think I've ever seen her since. And now that she's doing like American Horror Story with all the camp stuff, it's hard to see that same performer.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said earlier about the sort of heightened glamour of the 80s and sort of expectation of how women were supposed to look, because she actually has this real sort of like loose and like blousy, I guess, sort of like glamour to her, you know, that is not overly made up and it's not exaggerated and her hair's really sort of short and, you know.
Yeah. And we see the real, like, the whole point of the scenes they have is that she's not on set. So we see the real version of her. So she's got sweatpants on a lot and she's...
Yeah.
I was thinking, like, did people have... Those aren't yoga pants. It's 1982.
Yeah, right.
They're proper sweatpants in the dinner scene.
But, because all those scenes that you see them in together, it's just sort of two girlfriends sort of hanging out. So she does sort of... You do see the character sort of with her guard down and in a really engaging, accessible sort of way, you know? She's so great in it, and it's so interesting because I assume that it was, I mean, you said that King Kong was maybe the only,
it was her first big studio movie, almost her last,
but she got offered Tootsie without, she didn't even audition, there was no script when they offered her the role, but I guess Dustin Hoffman had met her at a party and thought that she was the most naturally sort of, and you see it in the movie. She's got such a natural sort of like beguiling quality, and you don't really know what it is, but she does. And I think Sidney Pollack felt the same way. And they both, you know, they both sort of describe it in interviews on the DVD. They say that she just sort of, they were like, oh, we got to get her. Like, we'd be so lucky to have her. And they flew to the set of Francis to talk to her about it and to basically ask her if she'd do it when there was no script. There was no script at that point. Like, she needed to sort of just take a leap of faith and want to do. And she said that, I forget who the older actress was who told her this, but I think it was an older actress who was in Francis, and I don't remember who it was, but told her, you're going to have to do a comedy after this. And so because she had said that, and then Tootsie came along even without a script, obviously, you know, it was Sidney Pollack and Dustin Hoffman, so she was like, she agreed to do it.
Sure, who would say no?
But I think that she said that she was nervous about it because she isn't a comedic actress, and she didn't play it like a comedy. She doesn't play it like a comedy at all. You know, she's not particularly funny in the movie.
Yeah, from her perspective, it's a relationship picture.
Yeah,
basically,
totally.
But I wondered for a long time since I finally heard the story, like years ago, of the evolution of the screenplay, just how much of that is down to Elaine May finding roles for both of the female characters and creating a romantic triangle that is, it's almost cruel. the way Gar's character is handled. Uh-huh. She's constantly being forgotten about and, totally. And left in the lurch, or you know, complaining about 3 hours later, you know, like how the roasts are ruined.
Yeah,
and all that.
Yeah.
But then she does still have that scene where she says, you know, like, I get to feel the way I feel, and you get to know that it's your fault.
Yeah,
which is so like. It's crushing because it reminds us that for all the anxiety and the flapping and the silliness that Terry Gard does so well, that there's a person under there with feelings, and she's at least as valid. Her feelings are at least as valid in this situation as anybody else's, and maybe more so because we've spent the entire movie laughing at her.
Totally.
Yeah, that snap in the structure is just so smart.
It's so smart the way that they parallel the way that obviously Michael is treating her with the way that Dabney Coleman's character is treating Jessica Lange. So at the same, that you know, he'll literally be, you know, Dorothy will be sort of giving a pep talk to Julie about, you know, the way that Dabney Coleman is treating her, and then she'll suddenly realize that, you know, he's forgotten that he was supposed to have dinner with Terry Gar, and Terry Gar is, you know, sitting at home with a burnt, you know, roast or whatever it is. And it's so genius the way they do that. And it's also interesting because, like you said, you know, Terry Gar gets so horribly mistreated in the movie, and yet you never, maybe just because it's such a like it's such a fantastic comedic performance, you never feel totally, I mean, you feel bad for her, but you're also sort of, she doesn't completely lose her. It seems like she should completely have lost her dignity or time and time again. But there's still something about her. Maybe just that she's such a fantastic character.
Yeah, I think it just feels that she's real. Like, she feels like she's not a caricature. And if she was a caricature, even just the fact that whole... that incredibly tricky I want you scene... where she's showering, he's about to try on her clothes, she comes out of the shower, and clearly this platonic relationship is still platonic, except that he's now has to jump her. And it becomes like it's like a James Bond level of using a woman. Like, it's wrong.
Right.
Every
totally.
Level. And we know it's a mistake, and the characters don't. And I think that I wonder how that played for adults in 1982, because for me it was just weird. Because it didn't make a lot of sense when I was a kid. But of course I was unaware of the free love, casual sex, like AIDS hadn't really hit yet.
Right.
Of course everybody's sleeping with everybody. Which is also why he can be such a player in the opening sequence, isn't it? That's
totally.
Just how people interacted.
Yeah.
Stay a while. Come on, you know, I want your coat to be the last one off the bed.
Right.
Which is so creepy. It's like finding out the next couple of years, you know, like you watch Ghostbusters and you realize that Bill Murray's basically a pickup artist in all of his scenes with Sigourney Weaver, and they're incredibly uncomfortable. And
right.
He's just like, he's not even hitting on her. He's pressing himself into her. But here, there's a point where you can write it off to Michael just doing whatever it takes to get a part, which we've already seen him do. And at the same time, it's just, she's lonely, and of course she likes him. Of course she likes him, and she's the Baxter.
Yeah.
In this one, she's the one who's going to get left for the better match at the end. And it's really, I think it's really amazing how we can actually see it all. You can see it from every perspective in a farce that's moving at the speed of light, because someone, either Pollock is smart enough to pick up on the emotional dynamics of the actors, or May was smart enough to write all of those scenes from the woman's point of view. And you know,
Elaine May, so she created the character of Julie and the character of Sandy and the character of Jeff that Bill Murray plays. Like, none of those characters were in the script before Elaine May came along. So, you know, this uncredited rewrite that she did is extremely extensive. But I also love how, Sandy's final moment in the film is saying sort of, don't call me, I'll see you at rehearsal. He says, what about the play? And she's like, I think I should tell you to shove your play, but I am an actress. And so, you know, she gets to sort of storm out and say, see you at rehearsal, don't call me. And then you never see her again for the rest of the movie, but you do see sort of the marquee outside of the theater in Syracuse, and it, she has top billing underneath Michael Dorsey and Sandy Lester or whatever. And I sort of love that, because she gets this, I mean, you're supposed to, I mean, they tell you it's a great, she says it's a great part, and he says he thinks it's a great play, which you sort of, you know, even though Sidney Pollack says it's, nobody's ever gonna want to see it, the fact that he's now sort of a marquee name post, you know, soap opera or whatever, right, makes you think like, oh, she, you know, she actually gets a great starring role, and people are gonna see this play because Michael Dorsey is now a name, and so it's such a subtle thing, that sort of that marquee that you see, because it's only one shot of it, and I think that's the only time you're in Syracuse, unless the farm is in Syracuse.
Maybe,
I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's upstate, but I don't know.
Right, because I think they show it to you right before he goes to the Charles Durning's bar and sort of meets up with him. But
yeah,
but anyway, so you do have the sense that at least sort of you, I think you get the sense from just from that sign, or at least I do, that like she's gonna be okay. She's better off than she was at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
Even though she had to go through these sort of you know,
horrible convolutions.
Horrible indignities. Yeah. But you
but
know,
that's like that's positively Shakespearean, right? The concept of the farce in which all the pure, all anyone whose intentions are pure is rewarded rather than punished.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow you have this love triangle where everyone is wrong and everyone is simultaneously justified.
Right.
To the point where Julie is ultimately open enough to deal with the attraction that she's feeling to a person she thinks is a woman.
Right.
And an older woman.
Right.
And
I love that. I love that in it too.
It's daring.
The fact that she's sort of...
And it's not for laughs.
No, yeah.
It's a real crisis for her.
Totally. And the fact that they say... You know, in the scene where he tries to kiss her as Dorothy, and she says, you know, I know what that impulse was. Obviously, I had the same impulse. And so there, she is addressing the fact that she had those, has those feelings, and obviously she's confused about them, but not in some sort of, like, grotesque, over-the-top way. You know what I mean? The fact that it's another woman, and like you said, that it's an older woman, is not played for cheap laughs at all, which I think is so... especially for that time.
Yeah.
Well, so,
given that everything else was, you know, like the Partners, the movie with Ryan O'Neal and John Hurt as a straight cop and a gay cop who have to pretend to be a couple.
I've never seen that.
It's terrible. And it's
nobody's. And it's funny that, like, you know, I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry. It was only a few years ago when you think about that, that movie was only a couple years ago.
Yeah. And considered a good idea.
It's mind blowing.
Yeah. It's incredibly progressive as a movie from 30 years ago, and even now that, and I was trying to figure out if there was a way, because someone surely will try, now that we've reached the point where trans characters and trans performers are not just accepted but considered a valuable part of anything. It's not just, you know, hey, we have RuPaul in this from 10 years ago. Now you have Transparent, and you have you know, Orange is the New Black, and you have all of this stuff going on where it's an actual conversation with the audience, and if you don't like it, you can go watch something else anywhere else. But there is, the stuff is there, and it's not being shamed, it's not being yelled at, it's not being shouted down. I don't think it would be possible to remake or channel the energy of Tootsie, but I don't think that it's because it wouldn't work. I think if somebody was really, really brave, they could probably pull it off.
There was an interesting HBO pilot that Mike White did that I read the script for.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that that they passed on, but it was about a I think it was like a Texas. Yeah, I think it was like a drag queen in Texas or whatever who gets sort of like loses her boyfriend and gets kicked out of her apartment and, you know, loses her job and is a drag, like, I think country western singer, like drag performer, and gets a job working as like a nanny for like a conservative, sort of like a wealthy conservative southern family or whatever, and has to pretend that he's a real woman or whatever to get this job as like the family nanny or whatever, and I remember reading it and thinking like, oh, this could be, because it's Mike White, and I think that I was like, I'm interested in what this could be. I mean, ultimately it didn't get picked up, which is kind of a shame, because I think it could have been interesting.
Yeah, and I would trust White to at least make it human instead of farcical.
Totally.
And we haven't even mentioned, you know, like the dark side of Tootsie, which is Mrs. Doubtfire, which is, I mean, I didn't like it then.
Right.
Only seems more, because the argument I made at the time was that people were comparing it to Tootsie because, of course, a man is dressing as a woman, but Mrs. Doubtfire is the Tootsie from the universe where everyone is raised on lead, where everybody's just fundamentally unable to see people clearly. And, you know, that's why Mrs. Doubtfire is beloved by children, because Robin Williams as a granny is funny, but it's got no base. Like, there's absolutely no connection to the real world,
right,
or human emotion in all of it. And the idea of someone disguising himself as an elderly British woman to spy on his own children and his own wife, like,
yeah,
it just gets uglier and uglier. And it's all the things that Tootsie doesn't even think about.
Yeah, well, it's that's funny, because I feel like as a kid, obviously, I loved Mrs. Doubtfire,
right, and I'm not asking you to.
No. And I haven't seen, but I haven't seen it since I was a kid, and whereas something like Tootsie didn't really register for me, I think it's because it didn't hit me over the head,
sure,
or it's not overtly, wasn't broad and overtly jokey in the way that, you know, a Mrs. Doubtfire is. But I think that's because, you know, I think the origin of Tootsie comes from a very serious, and like you said, you know, Dustin Hoffman basically is Michael Dorsey, or that was, Michael Dorsey was Dustin Hoffman in the first 15 years of his career when he couldn't get a job. And you know, it the origin of it came from a real thoughtful, introspective place, which was him and his writer friend. So originally it was him and his writer friend, I think Murray Schlegel or Schlegel or something.
Oh yeah, the guy that he keeps crediting.
Yeah,
the idea.
So they're walking down the street and they are having a conversation about how every man has a woman who lives inside of him, and they referred to that woman as Shirley. So everybody has a Shirley inside of them.
Okay.
And so the question that they wanted to explore with the movie was not, you know, not what would it be like if you had been born a woman necessarily, but if you, I'm getting this wrong now.
Well, if you were, if I'm remembering it, it's if you were thrust into the situation of having to respond as a woman,
right,
to see the world that way and see yourself that way,
right, and I think that, you know, in it was very ahead of its time in terms of just like not making a joke really about gender or that sort of. I mean, certainly there's a lot of jokes at the expense of the character and the unattractiveness of the character or whatever, but there's so much heart underneath it, because I think you know, it comes from a real place in Dustin Hoffman, sort of feeling, growing up and feeling like an outsider and feeling unattractive and how, you know, like I said, how it would be 50 times worse had he been born a woman, with the same level of attractiveness, but a woman.
Yeah. And the other part of that too, that feeds in, that the part that makes it okay to laugh, is that all the jokes are ultimately at the expense of Michael Dorsey's ego. Because as he says in the beginning, this would be the greatest acting challenge ever.
Right.
And he believes it, and he believes he is a great woman as Dorothy, and, you know, to the point where he's disassociating himself and like, I think Dorothy deserves this. I don't know about this. Do you think Dorothy would wear these earrings for Dorothy? Are they too flashy? Where he's so far into the role playing that he's lost perspective on how horrible this is, what kind of a betrayal it is to everyone he's working with, and to women, and to the concept of acting.
Yeah,
with that gimmick, we're allowed to enjoy every little bit of humiliation that comes his way, because he's reacting from it from a place of no, I'm doing this perfectly well.
And from the very beginning, he's sort of, I think that the reason that the character is liberating to the audience and to the other women on the show is because he's bringing an inherently male sense of entitlement to this woman who he's portraying. In a way that, like, you know, women, sort of the audience and the women on the show have never seen before.
Yeah, I mean, there's talk about how she's not masculine, she's just angry.
Right. The power making a woman masculine.
Yeah, and his deflection of that as a man playing a woman is kind of incredible. Just the way that I'm sure that Elaine May, having directed movies, had already had these conversations with people, and, you know, like the, I wish I could remember who it was, but you hear it every time. I think Ava DuVernay was talking about it most recently. Is like, when a woman demands that you follow her point of view artistically, she's a bitch. Mm-hmm. If it's a man, he's just a visionary.
Mm, right.
Or not just a visionary, but it's okay. Like, you can't be... The idea that you can make a film and be demanding or make give a performance and be focused and refuse to take notes and push forward is a distinctly male concept,
mm-hmm.
even now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... Yeah, it's
and we sort of
amazing.
I feel like men sort of take that for granted. We sort of like sure. it's like our birthright. And
yeah.
and
well, it's the whole men's rights thing, right? Like nobody yeah. would ever like well, what do you mean? Nobody's ever told me I'm an asshole.
right.
I get what I want.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's all that is.
Yeah, what are men's rights?
Yeah.
Rights. But did you see that episode of Master of None?
I've seen the first few.
Oh, okay. Because there's an episode, I think it might be like 8 episodes in or something, where the opening sequence is Aziz and his buddy at a bar, and a young woman played by Khandala Rashad, you know, Felicia Rashad's
oh, yeah.
daughter. The actress. So she, they're at the same bar together, and then it follows both of them home, their walk home from a bar at night, and how men just sort of take for granted the fact that they can just like you know, at you know 1 a.m. in New York or whatever, you can just walk home and not be scared for your life or that someone is following you or is going to chase you into your building. And men have no idea, they don't think about that, they sort of take it for granted. But the sort of shit that women have to put up with, it's a very funny, very smart episode of that show, I think. But
oh, I'm really glad somebody's doing that.
Yeah,
I like what I've seen. I just it dropped right around the same time that screenings really picked up.
Oh, right.
It's still sort of.
You should pick it back up because there's some really good stuff in there. But it's you mentioning Ava DuVernay, it made me think of that. Did you read that article in the New York Times Magazine about the lack of opportunity for female filmmakers?
Yeah, yeah.
And one of my favorite quotes in that article was Meryl Streep saying how you know, because it's you know, older white men who run the studios and that sort of has a trickle down effect.
Sure.
You know, they want to hire, you know, men who remind them of themselves or who, you know, are groomed in their image or whatever. And she was saying that men are never, boys are never encouraged to imagine what it would be like to be female. And that was a quote that I really thought was thinking about a lot when I was watching this movie, and how, you know, in 1982, coming off of Kramer versus winning the best actor for Kramer versus Kramer, and literally, you know, they developed this script for like 3 years, and Dustin Hoffman could have done any movie he wanted to, but he was so intrigued and so interested in exploring his femininity that this is the project that he chose to make, which is sort of, I feel like it's unheard of now, and it even then I feel like is sort of amazing. I mean, I think the word, you know, the word brave gets sort of thrown around a lot, but to me that's a brave sort of endeavor at the peak of your career to sort of want to make a movie like that, I think, you know, because
yeah.
I think it's such a rare thing. And well, that's why I think the movie, I don't take it for granted now when I watch it, you know what I mean? Because I think that it's, I really admire him for that.
Yeah, I can't think of another actor who's sort of gone there in that way, at least not with that level of commitment. I mean, I think about maybe Ryan Gosling in The Notebook making choices that aren't macho choices for that character, but still with the big muscles and the kissing in the rain and all that. Like, that's as close as I can come.
Yeah.
And it's nothing like what Hoffman does. And, of course, it's in an era where we're already starting to accept more sensitive and thoughtful. I mean, you know, you can't really... Part of the brilliance of Tootsie is that you can't picture Redford.
No.
Like, you can picture Redford in The Graduate. That was Nichols. That was one of the original concepts. But you can't picture anybody else doing this way. It's just such ownership of that role and that tightrope, again, of being able to make fun of himself as a serious actor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole, this is after Marathon Man, after the why don't you just try acting stories, you know, like about how he was... Now we have Leo DiCaprio eating raw animal liver, shooting a scene in The Revenant to chase some sort of truth, which is...
That I have less than no interest in seeing that. Like, that to me does not resonate in any way. But the idea that sort of, you know, Dustin Hoffman would want to go to these places and explore these things that men are so harshly judged for, and men rarely admit that they do, or that they think about what it would be like to be a woman, or what put themselves in a woman's shoes. You know, it's considered weak, or it's considered, you know,
Well, vulnerable is still seen as weakness.
Yeah, totally.
Right? Emotional openness and honesty are still bad things.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you know, like Gosling's character in The Big Short perfectly embodies that sort of alpha male bullshit thing that he does so beautifully, but it's a comedy, so it's allowed.
Yeah, right.
If you met that guy, you'd walk very quickly to the other side of the bar.
Right.
But yeah, Michael Dorsey is initially like a self-serious, entitled...
Mm-hmm.
At least he thinks he's a coxman, you know, like he's getting at everybody, and he's just trying to be. He's at 38. He's the voice of wisdom and the best person for the job of acting coach and all that. But he's also an idiot who has no idea what he's getting into, which is why it can be comic instead of dramatic.
And it's so important that he be. It's actually important to the story that he be. I mean, for comedic effect, but also that he be that self-serious and that he be that sort of unapologetic, because you know when you know Sidney Pollack's character, or when Bill Murray's character is cracking jokes about his appearance, or you know, why are you really doing this, or you need therapy, or you're not doing this just to, like, you know, put on little frilly dresses and stuff, he doesn't ever apologize. Like, he doesn't ever
he never laughs it off.
No, never laughs it off. He takes it really seriously, and I think that's partly why, you know, he's able to become a better man in the end, right? Because he takes being a woman to heart.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And what women go through to heart, you know?
As painful as that might be.
Yeah.
For the character, and as funny as it is for the audience. We get to watch it's the weirdest hero's journey. Because he does commit to it fully and suffers and endures and does everything. Like, I'm thinking of Dan Harmon's Story Circle with the meeting with the goddess. He's got several goddesses in this case. But, it comes out. He does come out the other side a better person. And someone who, you know, this is my thing about love stories and romantic comedies. You want the characters to deserve each other.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want them to just be perfect for each other. You need to see them fight through this and earn their romance, earn the love that comes at the end. And this really does do that.
You know what else is awesome? The way that the movie doesn't ever shame Jessica Lange's character for her choices. The fact that she's the fact that she's, you know, a single mother, she's never married, and she says, again, because in the guise of, you know, just hanging out with another girlfriend, although I don't think that she would be apologetic about her decisions to anybody, which is cool. She's very cool. Like, she's a cool character. She's sort of...
Single mom who drinks.
Yeah, exactly. And has got a really, like, a good, like, high-paying job. She's on a cheesy soap, but she doesn't apologize for it.
Yeah.
You know, she's making good money.
Yeah. She's great with the fans as opposed to some of the other actors.
Totally.
You can
totally. Gina Davis is a little bit.
I don't write this shit.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And drinks.
Yep.
And, you know, when Dustin Hoffman's character, when it's sort of, like, brought up in... You know, when it's sort of, when he brings it up and she says, you know, you don't have to worry about it. And then they sort of drop it, and she keeps drinking throughout the movie. She doesn't stop. She doesn't have some sort of, like, you know, when they meet up on the sidewalk at the end of the movie, there's no, you know, Dustin Hoffman is the one who has to do the work and has to make the apology. And there, she doesn't have any sort of, well, I quit drinking, or I've been in rehab, or, you know what I mean? Because it would have been so easy for her character.
Coming out of an AA meeting or something.
Totally.
Just do it without any dialogue at
all. Totally. Yeah. But they don't do that to her. And even I noticed it the last time I watched it, because, you know, the music, the closing credit music comes in as they're sort of walking away, so you can't really hear what their conversation is beyond her asking if she can borrow the dress, the yellow dress or whatever, and he says, oh no, you'll ruin it, and that's sort of the last thing you can, like, really hear. And then I was sort of like, I turn the volume up to hear what they're saying as they're walking away, and she says, no, I won't, and he says, yeah, you'll spill wine all over it, and she says, no, I won't, and so they're laughing about it and whatever, and so she doesn't have to be. It remains sort of like part of her character that she enjoys a couple glasses of wine at the end of the day. And, you know, she works hard, and, you know, she doesn't have to go through some sort of, like, repentant.
Yeah, she doesn't have to be redeemed.
Transfer. Exactly. Exactly. Because she's cool to begin with.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, she does get rid of... The one thing that she does do is sort of kick Dabney Coleman to the curb. And Dustin Hoffman does, you know, or Dorothy does obviously help her do that. But that, you know, beyond that, she's pretty cool. She's pretty together.
She gets to own her own choices. And she gets to be the romantic lead in a movie that doesn't even know it needs one.
Like, right.
Until she's interested. Until that.
And the straight man, too, happens. Opposite.
That's true.
You know, which is important.
Yeah. No wonder she won the Oscar. I mean, I'm still surprised it's the only Oscar that the film won. But
me, too. I thought that Dustin Hoffman had won. I mean, to me, it's maybe my favorite, one of my favorite performances in a movie ever. I think probably my favorite male performance of all time. Yeah, and it is interesting that the least comedic performance is the one that won the Oscar. Like, she beat Terry Garr, which sort of kills me a little bit, because Terry Garr is so genius in the movie, but in a different way. And Dustin Hoffman, actually, he said in an interview that when he knew he wasn't going to win, though, because they were a comedy, and comedies are considered sort of second class.
And they were up against Gandhi.
Exactly, they were up against Gandhi, which I've never seen, to be fair.
It's a big... like, we were talking about 70mm Roadshow FX. Uh-huh. That was one of the big ones the early 80s. It was, you know, the wall of stars underneath the big picture of Sir Richard Attenborough presenting. And it is the kind of prestige movie that, of course, it was going to win.
Right.
It was made to win.
And he said that he walked in and he tapped Paul Newman on the shoulder and sort of startled him, because he was nominated for The Verdict, which I've also never seen The Verdict. And he was like,
great.
I should watch it. But I guess he said to Paul Newman, he was like, you know, we're not going to win, right? Because, but The Verdict is not, is The Verdict, does that have a comedic element to it?
Not really, no. I mean, it's a mammoth script, so it's snappy, but it's not a straight up comedy.
Maybe he just meant because, like, nobody stood a chance next to
I think so.
Ben Kingsley.
Newman's fantastic in The Verdict. It's a really great performance. Mm.
It is funny when you think, like, about those performances, like, how did that not win? And then you go back and you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
You're like, you look at the other nominees and you're like, okay, well, that was 82 was a good year. 83 was a good year.
It was a strong year.
Yeah.
So the it's good that we've moved into the acting aspect of it, because the closer on the show is always the same, which is, you know, like, is there anything that you've taken or stolen or borrowed or used, either as a writer, as an actor, a director? Is there anything from Tootsie that's shown up in your own work that you feel... was conscious?
Well, it's a good question.
Yeah. We end on introspection.
Right, right. I think now that I'm writing, and I'm writing in the voice of, you know, I'm writing female characters, because honestly, when I was growing up, like, the, you know, my favorite films were predominantly, you know, female let, and there were so many good ones in the 80s, like, you know, from 9 to 5 to Broadcast News to Working Girl to all these movies, and Tootsie is sort of the only one, actually, that of my favorite films of that era that has a male lead, I think.
Okay.
And yet it's a male lead playing a woman, and I think that I think now it's sort of risen to the top of my favorites, because it is, because I do relate to it that much more, it being about a man who's getting in touch with his feminine side and so sort of, you know, co-writing with Lauren and sort of creating characters for her and writing in her voice. You know, I've always had very strong female friendships and very strong female artistic collaborators, and I think Dustin Hoffman's just sort of like allowance of that, and his real interest and commitment in exploring that side of himself is something that, you know, as a writer, I'm, you know, creating, you know, female roles that I want to see on screen, right. You know? And, in order to do that, I have to sort of be, I guess, be in touch with the Shirley inside me, you know what I mean? And not feel ashamed of it, or not apologize for it. And so, I don't know that, you know, Tootsie, when I first saw it, it definitely didn't have that sort of effect on me. But as I've rewatched it over the years, as I've been sort of writing and developing projects with, you know, female characters in them, I think it's really, inspired me in that way.
So it's a touchstone on a number of different levels.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think it's now, now it's a movie that I think I'll always sort of go back to, for, you know, as an actor, because all the performances are so brilliant, and as a director, because it's so skillfully made, and as a writer, because it's so well structured and the dialogue is so fantastic. So it kind of sort of, all the things that I'm sort of do and want to continue doing, it's sort of a gold standard for all of those things.
My thanks to Ben Lewis, whose short film Zero Recognition is available on Vimeo and is well worth 10 minutes of your time. Keep an eye out for his next short, which he mentioned on the episode. We'll let you know when it's coming. And if you're a recent follower of this podcast, maybe go back and listen to Lauren Collins' episode on Obvious Child, you know, for context. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenLewisHere, all one word, it looks like Ben Lewisher, which is weird. And you can find Tootsie on Blu-ray and DVD in an excellent special edition from the Criterion Collection. You can also find it for sale and rental on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, or on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, try to do it in an approximation of Dorothy Michael's voice. Thanks for listening.
All of those, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.